This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over. And Crystal Hannah Kim is a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 author. She has, her second novel is just out now, The Stone Home. You know her name from If You Leave Me, which made lots of best of the year lists when it was first published in hardcover in 2018. Am I getting that year right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Stone Home. I did not know any of the backstory to this book. And I mean about the Korean history that informs this novel until I read this book. And then, of course, you sent me down a rabbit hole. But before we get too deep into it, this kind of came out of a trip you made to the DMZ between North and South Korea, right? Like, isn't that when you learned about the backstory as well?
Yeah. Well, first, Miwa, thanks so much for having me. I'm very excited to talk to you. I learned about these reformatory centers through an Associated Press article in 2017. I read that in 2017 in Chicago. I was getting ready for If You Leave Me to come out, and I read about the South Korean government secretly sanctioning these institutions and rounding up kids off the street to kind of clean up their image. And then I set it aside. I kept thinking about it, but I set it aside. And then in 2018, I was visiting family and I went to the DMZ. I started thinking about the very different aspects of Korean history that are so interconnected, right? And the war in the 1950s leading up to these reformatory institutions under what was really a dictatorship in the 1980s. And then during that family trip to Korea, I actually sought out and found a survivor of one of the biggest reformatory institutions called the Brothers Home. His name is Han Jong-sun, and he is a big activist in Korea. And I actually met him outside of the Seoul National Assembly. He was living in a makeshift hut on the sidewalk outside of the gate. And he had the, you know, it was just this wooden structure with a plastic tarp over it. And he had these gigantic poster boards plastered with photos of what was really going on in the Brothers' Home, as well as these newspaper articles lauding and applauding the owner of the Brothers' Home. And, you know, the owner actually got awards for his good deeds in reforming, quote unquote, citizens, and I think got a medal from the government. You know, there was such a facade. So I ended up speaking to Han Jong-sun all day, and I had my aunt there. I can speak Korean, but, you know, it's sometimes nice to have someone who's kind of also a cultural interpreter as well. So my aunt, Han Jong-sun, and I went to a cafe. We kept talking. We got lunch together. We moved spots to a restaurant. We just had a really long conversation. And then it's actually after that conversation that I really felt like, I'm committing. I'm going to write this novel.
I really wanted to start there because I was shocked. And I mean, I know a little bit about the Korean War. I mean, there's a huge gap, obviously, in American publishing about the Korean War and the way we're taught about the Korean War. I think it's fair. A lot of folks refer to it as the Forgotten War. I mean, there's so much literature on Vietnam and World War II, certainly. But Korea just, it's a blip. And MASH doesn't count, right? Like, MASH is just doesn't count.
No.
And I got very attached to some of the characters. Obviously, you know the characters I did not get attached to, but it was one of those books that I kept sort of rolling around at the back of my brain after I finished reading it, because the true story behind everything is so harrowing and really dreadful. But I never felt like you were lecturing me. I mean, it was like, it's obvious this stuff is terrible. Like, we know this is bad. And yet you put these characters into situations that are terrible, but we get a really great read out of it. And I'm sort of trying to walk that line carefully, because I certainly don't want to diminish anyone's experience, right?
But right.
You kind of pulled off a thing here. And so you started writing in 17-ish, or you started writing after If You Leave Me came out?
I started writing a little bit in 2017, but, you know, you get kind of swept up in the publishing. It was my debut novel. I was working a nonprofit job that was really intense. And then it was after this meeting in 2018 that I really committed. But I want to go back to what you're saying about not lecturing. I hate it when books lecture, when novels lecture. I think it's kind of belittling the reader, right? And it's just not very interesting when a novel does that. So I really am glad that you didn't think the Stoneholm did that, because I think it's so important to write politically charged novels in a way that feels gripping and immersive and character driven, because that's how you make the readers care. And that's my main goal as a writer.
The mother-daughter relationship at the heart of this book, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, mom's a halfie. She's had a rough life of it. Her kid has never had a stable home. I mean, and this is the legacy of the war, right? Like, this is not a great society to be mixed in. This is not a great society to be a single woman who has no resources. There are a lot of things that this mother and daughter sort of pushed up against, and it's a lot.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, they obviously love each other. They don't quite understand each other.
They don't. I mean, what mother-daughter pairing ever really understands each other? Right? None that I know.
And I had a really great mama, but at the same time, it's like, I remember adolescence. So let's talk about the creation of these women, though, because, I mean, this is something that runs through both of your novels, is sort of looking at where women are and where they're going in Korea in a historical context. And, you know, there's a little bit of research that goes into that, but there's also just a lot of writing and rewriting and characterization. And so let's talk about the creation of these women.
Yeah, we have the narrator, Eunju, and her mom, Kyungho. They're taken into the reformatory center, which is called the Stoneholm, in 1980. And I'm always drawn to mother-daughter characters. I can't seem to escape them. I think it's just this fascinating theme that will show up in my writing no matter what. And actually, Eunju, who is the main narrator, who's the heart of the novel, she actually wasn't in the first draft.
Wait, what?
I know.
I'm sorry, what?
I know, it doesn't make sense, right? But I kind of thought, okay, I'm writing my second novel. I want to challenge myself. I want to do something different. Mm-hmm. So initially, the Stoneholm, I was thinking of it as two narrators, two alternating narrators, but I wanted it to be a father-daughter story. And so it was actually just 1980, Sangchul, he and his brother are in the institution. And then there was actually a section in the 2000s from his daughter's perspective, Nade, in Brooklyn as a Korean-American, just wandering around trying to search and learn more about her father. That was actually the initial draft. I wrote maybe like 70, 80 pages. I spent months on this form. And in my gut, knew it wasn't clicking, but I just kept going because I couldn't figure out what I needed to do to fix the story. And I remember I was actually at an artist residency in Wyoming, Gentel, and it was snowing. I was in my cabin and I was writing from the perspective of Nada in 2011. She's looking through photographs of her dad as a child or a teen in the Stoneholm. And in this photograph that Nada finds, there's a group of kids and there's a girl there. And as I'm writing Nada, wondering who that girl is, I started wondering who that girl was. And I was just thinking, like, who is that girl? How did she end up in the Stoneholm? Like, what's her story? And, you know, a couple of days later, I thought, you know what? I need to relegate Nada to, you know, a frame structure. And I need to investigate this girl. I need to figure out how she got into the story. And so really, Eunju just kind of came at me full force at that moment. And then she became the heart of the story. So it's kind of wild to think that she almost didn't exist in this novel. But I think she would have found her way eventually.
Yeah, because when you're writing, you're sort of, I mean, it sounds like from what you just said, you're puzzling through. You're not necessarily working off of a formal structure. I dread the outline word, but.
No, I can't do an outline. I admire writers who can, but for me, I'm such a question-driven writer. You know, I'm just writing to figure out something that I'm trying to understand about the world. And I also think that if I were writing against an outline, it would just not be interesting to me, you know, because I'm writing to figure out what the story is. The first draft is really me just kind of like plotting around and examining and figuring out what the shape of the book will be.
Right.
So it takes forever, though. I don't love it. I always say I'm going to be an outliner, and then it doesn't happen.
You know, you've set two novels now in the recent past in Korea. If You Leave Me being what, the 50s and 60s, right? It's it's war and immediate post-war. And now the 80s, which, you know, 1980 may as well be the 70s. So you were clearly on a continuum. But, you know, as I was going back and sort of looking at some older interviews you'd done, you at one point had a writing teacher who was like, write what you know. And he's like, well, actually, he's telling me to write Korean. And I mean, clearly you're thinking about a lot of stuff that translates immediately to our lives in the current day, right? Like historical fiction essentially just reflects who we are and what we're doing right now. And it can be set in another country, but still it's our concern. You're Korean American, you born in Queens, raised in Queens. But I'm wondering though, how you come to write books like these when you're sort of walking around with that little bit of input from someone who was kind of missing the thread.
I know. I in college, I just would write these characters that had like no race or no identity, you know, and I think that's when that professor said that. And I resisted it for a long time. But I keep finding myself looking back at history to try to figure out our current moral state, like you were saying, because it's just constantly a cycle. And I really can't even, I can't dictate what I write next. It's just something that I have to follow my gut. I have to follow my instinct. I have to follow my interests. I did not think when I first read about these institutions in 2016, 2017, 2018, I didn't think I was going to write a book about it. I just couldn't fathom the lack of humanity in these institutions. And that made me want to keep reading about it, especially because these institutions happen time and again, you know, across cultures. And that ability for humans to oppress others in this specific way, right? These institutions have targeted Indigenous Australians, First Nations children in Canada, Black Americans. Why does this keep happening? How can we stop it? These kind of questions just kept running around in my mind. And eventually I just kind of gave in to the notion, okay, I have to write a book about it.
I mean, part of why I think it's really important to have novels like yours right now, too, is like K-pop obviously is a global force, right? Like Korean skincare, global force, like Korean beauty standards, too. All global forces. But I'm like, well, you kind of need to know where all of this is coming from, right?
Yes.
Like, yeah, K-pop's fun to dance to, but like the system behind it is a little rough on the artists, especially when they're women.
Yes, it's scary.
Right?
And yeah, Korea's all over, you know, pop culture nowadays. When I'm growing up, you couldn't find kimchi in the local bodega or the supermarket, right? People would constantly ask me, are you Chinese or Japanese? They didn't know what Korea was. So it's really kind of disorienting to see how popular Korean culture has become, Korean food, you know. And I'm, you know, I love that I can find kimchi at my local store, but there's definitely such a lack of awareness of the history and the United States involvement in the making of Korea's current governmental structures. And I think that's important. We got to know our history, right?
You've called it the Americanization of Korea. Like, that's how you've described it. And can we just give listeners who may not know what you're talking about a little bit of background? Because it's, I think it's really important.
Well, you know, I think, like you're saying, the Korean War is called the Forgotten War. And people don't know that even before the war, the North and the South had been bisected by the United States, by larger governmental entities, right? They don't know that. They think that that was just a result of the war rather than something that would continue after the war. They don't know that the United States military has still an extreme presence in the country. There's all these like pockets of knowledge that we weren't taught here in the States in our history books. And for me, I want to, for myself, look into those pockets because when, yes, I'm really interested in Korean history and how it is connected to us here in the States, but I also think it's a reflection or a refraction of just universal history, right? These repetitions of colonialization, these repetitions of structures of oppression, that happens everywhere. And I'm just really intrigued by that.
Well, and Korea was a Japanese colony for quite some time. I mean, your grandmother was 9.
She was young.
When the Japanese left. So, I mean, your grandmother, right? Like, not your mom, your grandma. This is really recent, though. I mean, our grandparents are not that old.
No.
I mean, the idea that, you know, little kids were taught, you know, Japanese history, Japanese, and I say this as a person who is part Japanese, Japanese history, Japanese language, Japanese culture, and their own was sort of buried. I mean, I really shouldn't necessarily be surprised that places like the Stone Home and the Boys Home and all of that existed. And yet at the same time, I'm like, oh, but you finally got the colonizers out. Like, what are you doing? Like, so the idea that you can internalize behaviors that you're taught. And then, of course, there's the whole flip side of being Japanese American and our legacy there. Like, it's just wild when you look at this continuum of history, right?
Yeah.
And the behaviors and the ideology.
The layer and the repetition of oppressors, those who are oppressed by oppressors then becoming oppressors is so interesting, right? There are these institutions, these reformatory institutions also happened under Japanese colonialization to reform the children of political dissidents, right? And then 40 years later, 40 years later, the Korean government then is doing that to their own citizens. And then within these institutions, there's kind of a smaller version of that where the captives, the inmates, whatever, the children, the ones, if you turn against your peers and climb this kind of like social hierarchy ladder and you can become a guard and then that allows you to have certain privileges if you are willing to oppress your peers. So there are these layers of oppression happening. And I think that's so horrific. And also, it just made me question, you know, like if I was in one of these institutions, what would I do to survive? Like, what are the limits of our humanity? If, you know, what would I do to protect my mother or my brother? That's a question that I wanted to look at for myself, but also in writing these characters, maybe have the reader wonder about their own capabilities.
You've switched POV from book to book. So you had multiple narrators in the first novel. This is, you know, omniscient third, which I think, I mean, listening to you earlier say, you know, you'd sort of planned on alternating chapters and whatnot. I sort of needed the distance for this one in a way that I didn't for the first. Partially because the 80s don't feel that long ago.
They don't feel
that long ago.
Exactly. It's not that long ago.
Technically, 1980 is historical fiction.
That's so wild to me.
It meets the technical definition.
What is the technical definition?
Something like 30 years, basically. Oh, or 30 years or 40 years. It's just, it's not that long ago. So If You Leave Me had 5 narrators, all first person. You're doing something slightly different in the new book with first person and third person. And I really did appreciate the distance that the third person brings. I really like Anju's voice. She's a little prickly. I think she has a really great kind of engaging, like, I want to know more about her. Like, I just, There was never a point where I was like, I get you. It was always, what are you hiding, lady? And I really appreciate that. But it, in terms of technique, you are playing on a different field. And I'm wondering why you felt like you needed to bring in the third person in the Stone Home.
Yeah. So we have Eunju in first person, and then we have Sungcho's narrative in third person. And they're in the institution at the same time. But I wanted to ground Eunju in first person as kind of like the heart of the novel. And I love a prickly narrator. I love a prickly, strong girl or, you know, woman who forces you to kind of wonder, like, who are you? Why are you this way? What can I learn more about you, right? But for Sangcha, the boy who gets into the institution with his brother, I wanted a third person perspective for a couple of reasons. One being, I thought we needed a little distance for the reader from his story, because though Eunju and Sangcha are very similar in temperament in the beginning, Sangcha's story kind of veers off, and, you know, I'm not giving any spoilers, but in a different way. You know, he chooses a different mode of survival. And so I thought that I needed a little distance there for the reader in order to for them to be able to kind of consume this story and feel empathy for the narrator or for the characters, right? But sometimes we need that distance, especially from violence. And also I wanted to play with this idea of storytelling. And there's this frame, right? In 2011, the novel begins with Made, a Korean American woman, arriving at Eunju's door. And so in some ways you can read this story as Eunju is telling her story in first person and Eunju is telling Sangcho's story in third. So I wanted to play with that as well and add in a layer of, is this her telling both of these stories at the same time?
You have an MFA, but you also have a grandmother who is a poet. You're bilingual. Your mom was also a poet, a poet? Okay, so lots of writing women in your family. Lots of translating into the gaps, right? Whether they're generational or cultural or what have you. Your grandma's just sounds really like a very cool lady. She raised you, right? I mean, for a chunk of your...
She's such a... I don't know if I can say this, but she's badass.
Yeah.
Can I say that?
You can totally say it.
She is just... I mean, she was an inspiration for me writing If You Leave Me, right? Because she survived the Korean War. And she came here in her, I think it's early 40s. She was really young grandma. You know, she came here specifically to take care of me because my parents were, you know, recent immigrants trying to figure out a way to survive here. And I just have this like intense bond with her. And she is uneducated, but so passionate and so creative. And she became a poet later in life, in her early 80s. She started writing poetry and was published in Korea. And I just think that she's just this incredible woman that I want to be like.
And you're always making sure that your characters, your female characters, have this sort of same swing to them, which I really appreciate because it's like, well, it doesn't matter whether you have formal education or not, like you can figure your stuff out. And this idea that somehow, you know, we have to be above reproach, right?
I know.
Respectability politics can seep in anywhere and it's kind of awful. And I love the fact that your women are your women. And knowing your grandmother's story, I can't help but think of her whenever I'm like, there's a character in the new book, in the Stone Home, who's basically sort of a house mother, right? And I'm kind of like, you know, she would probably terrify me if I ever met her in real life because she is so no nonsense.
Oh, yeah.
The goiter was a nice touch. I was just like, okay. But no, the idea that these women have to make their own space, right? Like they have to take care of themselves because no one else is going to do it. And they have to take care of their kids because no one else is going to do it. I mean, it's really fraught kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And yet here you are, you know, doing your thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think growing up, a lot of stories about, if there were any stories about Korea, right? Or stories written by authors about Asia they would always be about, you know, high class people or American soldiers or these kind of people that I didn't relate to. And so when I'm writing, I want to write about my people. And I come from a lineage of people who were not educated, but made their lives mean something, right? And they're like gritty and strong, and they push up against the constraints that are around them, right? To make a life for themselves. And that's what I'm really, really interested in. And that's how it's not even a conscious decision, but my characters are always from those kind of backgrounds because that's where I'm from. And it's just like part of my lineage that I want to explore. And it's much more interesting to me than writing about upper class Koreans or whatever.
Yeah. And I mean, if we're going to do the representational thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. let's be inclusive. And yeah. that inclusivity includes like class and education, mm-hmm. all sorts of things where it's just like, it's not just, you know, where you're from or the color of your skin or anything like there are lots of different kinds of, I think we need as many people at the table as we can get, you know, we can always yeah. squeeze more people in at the table.
I agree.
Okay. The other thing I learned about you, you mm-hmm. know, where I'm going next. You know, one of the things writers do when a new book is coming out is they write essays about themselves for places like The Cut, which is New York mm-hmm. Magazine's Vertical. And, okay, you're what, 5'2" in your bare feet?
I like to say 5'3", but I am closer to 5'2".
But here's the thing. You are not the biggest person I've ever met. Okay.
No.
And you know, you're you-sized, but you are not the biggest person I've ever met. And then I'm reading this headline. Mm-hmm. You were a wrestler in high school, and I just need and I've read the article and I love it and I totally understand it, but you are so amazingly stubborn. I love this.
I am
let's bring listeners in who have not yet read this piece, and I strongly recommend you go read it if you haven't. But you were the only girl on a high school boys wrestling team on Long Island.
Yes, I was first girl on the team. Yeah.
Okay, first girl, only girl. Your cousin mm-hmm. kind of dared you?
Yeah, you know, he kind of dared me. I really dared myself. But, you know, my cousin is a couple years older than me. He went to a neighboring high school, and he was telling me all about his high school wrestling matches and how it was the most intense sport. It was the best sport. And I just kind of rolled my eyes and thought, like, how hard could it be to survive like a 2-minute period, right? I kind of laughed it off and I said, you know, it doesn't sound that hard. And he said something like, you could never last a match, you know? And I understand when you look at me, I'm petite. I'm very like feminine looking. I understand that. But you know what? I also like it's essential to my being is I really like to play with people's expectations of me and surprise people. And so that offhand comment, I was just like, you know what? I'm going to be a wrestler then. And I was a wrestler in my high school team for 3 years, sophomore, junior, senior year. It was freaking hard. But you know, I also am somebody who will not give up. I am somebody who, yeah, like I like to subvert expectations. I think that's part of who I am as a writer too, but it was an incredible experience on so many levels. It taught me so much about, you know, perseverance and failure. I was a high school kid who was not used to failing, you know, like I did well in my classes and I played the flute, you know, stuff like that. And to lose almost all my matches for 3 years, that sucks. It's tough. And there were some moments that I wanted to give up, but I don't know. I actually really fell in love with the sport. And it was really fun and satisfying to be so aggressive and to be in a physical sport where I could like really, really rage. Because I grew up in the 2000s in a time of like extreme toxic masculinity. And I was pretty sick of the way I was being treated by society.
You know, I love the idea of high school you just taking up space, right? Taking up space. That's what the women in both If You Leave Me and The Stone Home Do. And they're in situations where they're not supposed to take up space. They're just not. And so the idea of like somehow 15, 16, 17 year old you permeating the backstory of both of these novels, like Tiny Wrestler. I'm glad you didn't take an elbow in the face.
I know. I mean,
high school wrestling it's a thing.
I had a lot of bruises, you know, and there was a rampant case of ringworm all the time. I mean, it was like pretty disgusting, you know, but yeah, I want to push up against people's expectations and I want to take up space. I mean, don't we all want to do that? The people that I know, right? We want to take up space and say like, hey, I'm here. Look at me. Think about my story. And that's what I want to do in my writing too. So I do think it's extremely surprising. It's like a funny dinner anecdote, but it makes sense when you know me, I would say.
Oh, completely. No, completely makes sense. It absolutely, absolutely, absolutely makes sense. And I say this as a former lacrosse player and field hockey player. And
Nice.
We all have our things that we did because, you know, we had parameters. It was really good to have that outlet. Like I really needed that outlet when I was coming up through school and just to have a way to sort of run off. I'm not really great at sitting still. That's kind of,
exactly.
I can do it.
No, we need it. Yeah. Like an outlet, right? For our physical rage, our physical exasperations, just like our energy. We need that.
But you spend so much time with these women in moments of our history where they have it much harder than we do. I mean, there are moments where I think, okay, world, have we not progressed? But overall, there has been some movement, right?
Yeah.
What's it like for you, though, when you're living so fully in these worlds? I mean, how do you switch gears so you're not suddenly, I mean, yes, you need to balance the needs of the story with what you're trying to do and, you know, sort of keeping it in the frame of where we are, but like also you don't want your characters to suddenly sound like they're living in 2024.
Yeah, I know. I think it's an interesting balance because I want to explore these themes that are kind of timeless, I would say, right? And universal, but I do want the novel to feel like it is taking place in the 1980s, which I guess is historical fiction now. But I also don't want it to sound dated. It's, you know, it's like a fine line that I'm weaving. And I think what I try to do is really focus it on the characters and their stories. So it was really important for me to have a physical space in the novel that was just devoted to the women. And they, you know, they have their own space in Little House. They are forced to make all the meals, so they take up a lot of space in the kitchen and they're kind of enclosed in that way. And I thought one way that I can really let us get it to know them is to allow them to have hours to themselves, allow them to be a source of caretaking and community, even if they can be prickly with one another, even if there can be a lot of gossip and you would expect there to be a lot of maybe backstabbing, but in their own quarters, when things get dire, they're going to stick up for one another. And that was really important to me because these questions about what does it mean to be a woman during that time, that is so essential to my writing and the way that I think about the world because I come from such a strong lineage. And I don't even know if strong is the right word, but I come from a lineage of women who are extremely strong, but grew up in extremely difficult circumstances, right? And I feel so grateful to be here, to have like all the luxuries that I have been provided. You know, my grandmother tells me stories all the time of literally peeling the bark off of trees to eat the inside inner bark, which is softer, you know, and that was my grandmother, those two generations away. So how far we've come astounds me. And I think it also I think that there's a sense of guilt there, which I don't know is necessary, but is something that I carry with me. And I think one way for me to kind of figure out that guilt is by writing about women like my grandmother and my mother.
And your mom and your grandmother obviously aren't your only influences. And I did mention earlier in the show you have an MFA, but I want to talk about some literary influences for a second. And obviously, I come back to your MFA because that sort of opens up your literary landscape in a different way, right? Like, you are also reading for homework and you're writing and whatnot. But can we talk about some of the really big literary influences for you?
Yes. Two writers that I love, which I'm sure you'll, you know, no surprise, I'm sure you love them too. Toni Morrison, Louise Erdrich. I had never read Louise until the MFA. I was introduced to Love Medicine by John Freeman. He was a teacher at Columbia. And oh my God, that novel just like broke open so many doors that I had kept closed in terms of what I thought a novel could be and what I thought a novel shape should look like. She is such an inspiration. So I love her. I love the way that she foregrounds and centers women's narratives, right? And her cultural history and background, but in these stories that are so immersive, right? In characters that are so memorable. That's what I want to do as a writer. And that's, you know, she's really like a beacon. Similarly, like Toni Morrison, I don't even know what to say. She's just the icon, right? Her language making, the way that she writes about power and race and women. You know, I discovered Paradise later on, only a couple years ago. And that was a touchstone in writing This Stone Home because it takes place in one house. And when I was writing this book, I really was trying to figure out, how do I make a novel that is in one contained space feel a good sense of claustrophobic, you know, but and not too, and not a bad sense. I don't know how to describe it. I want it to feel contained, but I also don't want it to feel repetitive, right? Or too exacerbating for the reader. And Toni Morrison's Paradise, that ending. So those are two writers I could, you know, kind of like yabber on about forever.
So two novels in, we've covered Korea in a couple of different ways. Stone Home does have a gal from Brooklyn, Nada. Mm-hmm. And 2011 was, in fact, not that long ago. I do not consider that historical fiction, for the record. But I'm wondering when you might start sitting more firmly in Korean America with characters like Nara. I mean, I'm not asking if you're going to write a sequel. I don't think you can with her for a couple of different reasons that we're not going to go into here, because obviously. But yeah, is that a shift you're looking to make?
Yes, definitely. You know, I keep joking to friends, I'm writing my way towards the present. I don't think that I'm the type of writer who's ever going to write a novel that's set in the exact time that I'm living in, like 2024, right? But yes, I do want to keep moving towards the present. And I'm playing around with a story that's set in like 2009, because I do want to write a 2009 financial crisis situation, New York, with a Korean American narrator, because I do want to write about those experiences. And I think that in my like understanding of myself as a writer, I needed to write the history and move towards the present. So my character is not connected in terms of actual lineage from If You Leave Me to the Stone Home to whatever my third book will be. But there is that kind of foundational stepping stone that I'm creating for myself. So yeah, I'm excited to get into a book that's set firmly in the United States.
And I can't wait to read it. I cannot wait to read it. I do. I mean, I think there's something to be said for creating a new space. Crystal Hannah Kim, thank you so much. Stone Home's out now. If You Leave Me is in paperback. And we're just going to wait quietly for the third novel.
Thank you so much, Mia.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.